This is The Conversation. It's episode 168 with Lauren Kaplan. She is a New York City-based art historian and, for our purposes, art tour guide. And as you can imagine, being an artist, if you're an artist listening to this and you've been in a gallery or museum when an art tour is going on and you're like, hey, I'm trying to see the art here, Lauren will answer to that and so much more. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Lauren giving her tours at the Met, maybe the Frick, the Guggenheim, perhaps her on the phone with me in Central Park, which is where she was adjacent to the Met between tours when we had our conversation. And really gives us a look inside these people who are leading these art tours. She does it freelance. She's not associated with any museum. She does most of them at the Met, as you will hear. And stay tuned on the back end. We have a four-pack of bad advice. Bad advice is back. And Lauren, in our conversation, alludes to an upcoming tour of a challenging artist to talk about, and so I will reveal on the back end how that ended up turning out. So stay tuned for both of those. Thank you very much for being here. Enjoy this conversation, and I will talk to you more on the back end. Hello.
Hi, trying again.
Okay, good. You got another spot?
Yeah, this is like perfect representation of my life. You get different information from different museum professionals.
Right. So where were you and where did you have to go to?
So I thought that I would have a longer break to go home to record this, but I'm on the Upper East Side in between tours. And I was in a quiet corner of the Greek and Roman galleries, which is where one guard suggested I go, and then they switched shifts and the new guards and I couldn't talk on the phone there.
Wow.
So anyway.
Sorry, what section?
I'm outside.
Yeah. You're outside. Wow.
I'm right outside. It's a lovely day and I don't think it's going to be too noisy. If you can hear me now, it should be fine.
And I hope you're warm enough.
Perfect. Yes. No, it's actually 65 degrees here today. So
wow.
I
okay.
am fine.
Yay, global warming.
I know. There's a silver lining to everything.
Right. So this is a significant venue and context that I'm talking to you because you have been doing tours at the Met Museum in New York, the world famous. Do I remember right mm-hmm. that you used to work there as well on staff?
No, I never was on staff at the Met, but I have been giving tours at the Met for approximately 5 years.
Uh-huh.
First working with another tour operator, and then for the last 4 years or so, working for myself.
When you were working with the tour operator, was that a official or designated Met tour operator?
No. Mm-hmm. It was another person who runs her own tour company.
What was the bureaucracy like getting into the through the doors in the first place for either of you, particularly for you?
There isn't a lot of bureaucracy, to be honest. The Met is probably the most liberal museum in New York in terms of allowing different guides in.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so if you have a group anywhere from, you know, I think the group size starts at 6 people,
mm-hmm.
but it goes up to 25.
Mm-hmm.
All that they require is that you make some sort of group reservation, and then you get a badge, and you buy everyone's tickets,
mm-hmm.
and you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
One of the wonderful things about that is that if you're someone like me, it allows you a lot of flexibility to lead groups around, and there aren't many issues with that. The downside, of course, is that they don't really require any credentials. So I'm in their system as a professor,
mm-hmm.
which is great,
mm-hmm.
but if I wasn't, and there are many people who aren't, who I have overheard, leading tours, giving a lot of misinformation.
Wow.
So there isn't a ton of quality control, which is kind of problematic sometimes, but it's, I guess, in some ways not my problem.
Right, right. Well, you know, that brings up a really interesting thought for me that, and it's maybe a more of a devil's advocate kind of thing that I think we should just get out of the way. And that is that, well, first of all, I'm going to play devil's advocate for you by saying, you know, here you are a professor, you know, presumably very well schooled in contemporary and modern art and you know, giving thoughtful and academic and also vernacular information to your followers, your tour group. And then you've got these cranks or quacks or, you know, phonies or whatever you want to call them. I'll let you come up with the right word, that are leading these tours simultaneously. But the point that I wanted to get to that you made me think of is from an artist's perspective like mine and perhaps people listening, you know, when I show up at a large size or big deal gallery, you know, and they have a tour going on there, I'm not going to be happy. You know what I mean? Because I'm going to have to, and this, I can actually remember this happening most recently, probably at the Hammer Museum. There were tours going on and I was like, how am I going to, you know, I need to race to get away as far away from this tour as I can, but wait a second, they're taking up this whole show right now. This is going to be tricky. You know what I mean? So let's just get that part of it out of the way. You can give your piece on it.
So what is the question? What do I do in the situation where I see a large group like that? Or
no, I think it's,
you want me to play the role of the guide when you're the artist trying not to be disturbed.
I think if you want a particular framing on it, I would say, to what degree are you cognizant? Like, let me put it very specifically. Let's say you're leading a tour in a Chelsea gallery, because you do mention on your site that you do Chelsea gallery tours, right? Let's say you're, you know, in the corner talking about X work of art on the wall or on the floor, and you see a couple of visitors to the gallery, like kind of heading towards your area, your group, and they're kind of giving you the evil eye. That's basically kind of the scenario that I want you to sort of play out in your here.
Well, what's interesting is that it goes both ways. Like most things. So on the one hand, you have visitors to the gallery or museum, wherever you may be, who are annoyed, frustrated, or feel somewhat disempowered because there's someone else speaking in the space they thought would be quiet.
Right.
On the other hand, you have visitors who, and it almost always breaks down along the lines of the more knowledgeable visitors don't want to overhear someone else talking. And, you know, I'm sure you would fall into that category, whereas someone who's just wandered in there who doesn't have any contextual information is very eager to overhear a tour.
Right.
And so I think it sort of works in both directions, where I often wind up with extra people glomming onto my group. and
freeloaders.
Yeah, which is sort of interesting. And that happens, like, I would say, way more often than the other.
Oh, good.
At least that's what I'm aware of.
Right.
But it must just be that I'm not aware of the people who are seething in the corner.
Right. Right. Do you get these glomer honors? How often do they become clients or, you know, featured tour guide people?
I think, you know, I don't know about a percentage, but maybe something like 20-25% of the time, those people will.
That's great.
Wind up, yeah, they'll either come over to me or they'll come over to one of the other people in my group and say, you know, what is this? And if it's me, they'll ask for my contact info and I'll give out a card. I try not to do that too much because I think it takes away from the experience for the people who have paid to be there. So, you know, I used to have an assistant who no longer works for me, but I'm trying to find somebody else. And one of the things that she would do was, if someone was interested or had any questions, she would give them my information so that mm-hmm. I wouldn't be interrupting the tour to do that.
Right.
And there definitely have been a number of experiences where it's usually, you know, a single person who's there by him or herself, and those people have become regular clients. So, so that's been great. But yes, there are definitely times where, to your original question, I notice that I'm frustrating one or two people by talking. And so I try to be really considerate of that and move away. I never try to completely block a work of art because that's very annoying. And so it's a way of really trying to, you know, be a considerate sharer of the space.
Right. So you mentioned the liberal policy of the Met. What has been your experience with Chelsea galleries, for example, or just any gallery, you know, Lower East Side galleries, if you ever do that, and the other museums? I mean, are there museums you wanted to get into with tours, but it's not possible?
It happens all the time. So Chelsea galleries, as well as Lower East Side galleries, and I'm not entirely sure because I pretty much only work in New York, but I think this is a blanket policy in most places. Anyone is allowed to come in with a group, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the Met and galleries are kind of the easiest places to take groups, especially bigger groups.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really trying to think. I haven't had any experiences of, you know, being asked to quiet down or leave a gallery for lecturing.
Right.
Whereas there are a number of museums in New York, and, you know, I'll speak to New York specifically, but this is true everywhere, that have very strict lecturing policies. So, for instance, MoMA, you're not allowed to lecture unless you are on staff. And even if you are on staff like I am, I'm not supposed to bring in outside groups that aren't registered through the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And what's another good example? The Frick. I had a very interesting experience at the Frick collection.
Do tell.
I'll tell you the full story because it's actually pretty funny.
And
I know you like the funny stories. Mm. But so this was about a year ago. I work with a group of retired, mostly women, but there are a couple men from Long Island, and they take a bus into the city from Long Island,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I usually meet them at the appointed museum or gallery or wherever we're starting, and we do a, you know, 2.5 hour museum gallery experience, have lunch, and then they go home.
Mm-hmm.
And so the groups are big. They're anywhere from 30 to 40 people.
Wow.
And yeah. So I usually split them in half and, you know, take half around while the others look on their own, and then we swap.
Mm.
So I had made reservations to go to the Frick and got approval to lecture to my groups if I split them up. And, you know, I'm on my way into the museum, and I was borrowing a friend's umbrella that happened to have Ai Weiwei's middle finger on it.
Uh-oh.
So essentially, like, flipping off the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm walking into the Frick on the Upper East Side, and someone comes from behind me and opens the door, and he's like, "Nice umbrella." And I turn around, and it's Owen Wilson. So that was kind of funny. And
for listeners,
for
listeners, do you want to tell people who Owen Wilson is?
Oh, I'm sorry. The actor known for The Wedding Crashers.
That Owen Wilson, not the Met Museum Owen Wilson. Got it.
Oh, I'm sorry. The actor.
Right. Thank you.
That's
okay.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So
I was totally in the art context, so I was like thinking Frick, you know, and then Owen Wilson. That name sounds vaguely familiar. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
This just sort of adds another funny element. So we both walk into the museum, mm-hmm. and I don't know what happens. I get my tickets. He disappears somewhere. And my group arrives. I split them up. I'm giving about 16, 17 of them a talk about the history of the museum. And, you know, about 10 minutes in, one of the guards comes over and he says, "I'm sorry, but you can't lecture to the group here." And I said, "Well, I was, you know, told that I could. I made a reservation," on and on and on. And at the same time, Owen Wilson walks by and is leaving. And another guard comes over and says, "Can you believe that the Wedding Crashers guy left after only 20 minutes? Mr. Frick would not be impressed. He did not give the collection its due." And so this whole thing is happening like at the same time. And the women in my group were totally confused. And then, you know, I essentially got into a, not an argument, but I was really trying to provide the best experience for my clients, for lack of a better word. Mm. And it became this difficult situation of, you know, can I talk to them? Where can I talk to them? And so the compromise that was reached was that I could, you know, basically deliver a lecture in the main courtyard area of the Frick, and then could not talk to more than five people at a time in the galleries. Mm. But mm-hmm. what's problematic about a situation like this is that because I'm bringing groups all the time, you know, if I go back with the two other groups from this town, because I usually lead three trips in a row with them, the mm-hmm. guards all know me by the second time, mm-hmm. and I can't play like I don't know the rules the second time around.
Right.
So it's just, it's a question of like getting the right information, making sure that everyone is on the same page, because oftentimes the person you make the reservation with is not on the same page as the guards, and the guards are the ones in the actual galleries.
Right.
So that type of stuff happens, I would say, you know, definitely not infrequently.
Sure. From a process-based perspective, you made me think about, for you, leading these tours, which you've been doing for about 5 years, you said, or at least this business anyway, maybe longer, you know, non-officially perhaps. But I can imagine that there is a mixture of, you know, you never know what to expect, you know, using that anecdote as an example, and it's a wild and crazy ride on one hand. But on the other hand, I can imagine, you know, when you're doing these talks repeatedly, that you can kind of go into this auto mode. And I guess I wonder where your experience tends to lie on an ongoing basis as far as that kind of spectrum.
In terms of trying to avoid going into autopilot.
Well, not so much. I would put it another way. I would just say more in terms of what is your, how does it feel for you? In other words, I'm not worried about how you're going to come off to your group. I'm worried more about, is it going to get boring for you, or is each
right.
experience a little bit different and therefore interesting?
Yeah, I think it's a really excellent question, and it's one I ask myself often because, you know, I do worry. Is this going to be enjoyable for me in another 5 years, let's say?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are two problems or two possible challenges. Mm-hmm. One is that it gets repetitive depending upon what I'm doing, and the other is it's pretty physically demanding and also, you know, physically and mentally exhausting mm-hmm. to be talking to large groups of people for many hours
mm-hmm.
at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on your feet the whole time. And, you know, as evidenced by today, you're often sort of like running around from one place to another. And I really like that now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm 34. I don't know if I'm going to want to be doing it when I'm 40 or 45. Or 50.
You're in the sweet spot of the tour guide, it sounds like. 34, I would imagine. Not too young, but young enough where you're still live and have enough energy, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, when I started working for someone else in my late 20s, I think a lot of people asked how old I was. And I look younger than I am. Maybe not as much now, but I did then.
Mm.
And so I was constantly, I felt like they were questioning my authority or my, you know, ability to actually know what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen very often anymore. And I think a lot of that's just that I'm more experienced and I come off as more polished. But yeah, it's true. I don't think many people do this for that many years because it is tiring. But back to your original question about it being possibly repetitive. I think it goes both ways. Because with the private tours, you know, the thing that I'm most often requested to do is a highlights tour of the Met.
Right.
And I have been doing variations on kind of the same tour now for 4 years. And I've switched it up, you know, every 6 months or so, I'll sort of add in a new chunk and take something else out. But there's still components of it that feel to me very tired. But I can't, for instance, not take a group to the Temple of Dendur in the Egyptian wing. It's just a highlight.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, you kind of have to go there. And then it also becomes a question of, all right, I'm constantly preparing for new things because they're changing exhibitions everywhere and trying to keep up on what's going on in Chelsea, et cetera. So do I really want to spend my time preparing a completely new highlights tour if at the end of the day it's not really going to be a better product than what I have now?
Well, it's interesting that you use the word better. Sorry, if I could just interject. It's interesting you use the word better product because I was thinking more in terms of popular product. You know, in other words, as you're saying all this, I'm wondering, okay, I'm off. If you go to my, you know, my Lauren Kaplan Art Tours website, you will see all of these different possible tours, and I can just kind of imagine, you know, your Long Island group, your Manhattan-based group, wherever, going, nope, give me the Met tour. That's what I want.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, and I had actually a very long talk with my father about this, who is kind of my unofficial business advisor, because he's been an entrepreneur for his whole life. He sort of dissuaded me from rethinking it. You know, I think he was like, it's not, people want the highlights and they love what you've been giving them. So you'd be doing it for yourself, which is important, but keep yourself interested with the other content and don't touch the one that works really well. So I've kind of taken that to heart. And I think that's right. And unfortunately, you know, I say it and then I bristle at the fact that I use the word product because I'm talking about art.
Right, right.
Which
I understand.
I don't even like to think of as a commodity. I'm not in the commercial art world, but I'm in this sort of commercial for-profit space within the museum world.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, so the thing that you made me think of, again, is going back to your experience giving these tours. So it comes down to the reality that your most popular product is the Met Tour. And so I can I can sort of imagine that the most likely way that you could keep it interesting for yourself is that each tour group is a little bit different, right? So you're going to be sort of going through your patter, your banter, you know, about each of the works and the rooms and so on. But you can look around and you go, oh, you know, that tour goer looks kind of interesting, or that tour goer is very outspoken or what have you. And so it's the dialogue that you get in, or the maybe the really sort of remedial questions that sometimes are still interesting or whatever. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you see where I'm getting.
Yeah, no, I think that is what, you know, the saving grace of doing a somewhat repetitive tour is everyone is going to have something different to say every time. I mean, and we can get into this more if you're interested, but my approach, I have used the word lecture a couple times and I do it more with very big groups. But if I'm doing a highlights tour at the Met for a family of four, which is in some ways my bread and butter, you know, it's very conversational. I don't lecture hardly at all. And so that makes it a lot more interesting for me,
sure,
because I let their questions and comments guide the information that I'm going to give.
Right.
And at the end of the tour, I've usually delivered a lot of the same information, but the order is different, the context is different, and the themes that come up are different. And one of the things I try to do to, I think, you know, it's to cater to them and to really make it the best experience for them. But also for me, I always ask ahead of time. I usually try to do it by email, but sometimes it doesn't happen. But I'll ask when the group arrives, you know, what if I ask the parents what they do for work, or if one or both of them don't work, you know, what are their interests? And same with the kids, because especially, and I feel like this happens most often with doctors. I've had a lot of doctors on different tours, and I try to bring in a lot of science connections. That's sort of become more of a recent interest of mine, is the crossover between art and science. And those conversations get really, really, really interesting.
Mm. Okay. What is the kind of work that you, that will provoke or promote that kind of conversation?
Well, there are a couple examples. I'll stick with the Met just because that's what we're talking about. So one of the objects I always show at the Met, because it's such a good teaching object, there's a mummy that the Met has CAT scanned. Mm-hmm. And you can find online the scans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we look at the mummy with the wrapping exposed, and then I show the scans. And the idea is to sort of to examine the skeleton to see how the person, it's a man, we don't really know anything about him, but how might he have died? And you can see that his femur is lodged all the way up under his armpit. And so clearly something happened that caused him to, you know, for his leg to be dislodged and essentially burst his lungs or his go into his internal organs. Sorry, it's a little gross. But, but you know, he was, we think anyway, killed upon impact. So the writing theory is that it was a chariot crash. So one thing is to sort of look at the scan and see, okay, how has science now helped us better understand this object? And mummification, of course, is already scientific. And then the other thing to talk about is the scan was given to a forensic artist. And the question that the Egyptologists were asking was, is the mask on his mummy realistic? Is it what he really looks like, or is it generic? And they had a police artist draw up a sketch based on the shape of the skull, and it looks very similar to the face that's on the mummy, which has led many people to say, and then he did this a couple different times with different scans. And so it's been, you know, one piece of evidence that at least in this later Roman period in Egypt, the face masks are pretty realistic and specific, which totally makes sense. So that's like one example. Another is like looking at color theory and how your eye takes in colors in a pointillist painting, and exploring that with a lot of other early 20th century artists.
Right.
So
when you have these clients, whether they're doing the 30, you know, to 40 person group tour or the family tour, is how often is there a graduation, if you will, or an evolution, if you prefer, to more challenging work, you know, whether it's Chelsea galleries or Lower East Side galleries, or I don't know, what maybe a different part of the Met Museum, you know what I mean? But I guess things that are maybe not quite so trodden for the masses.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I'm just thinking off the top of my head. I have, I don't know, maybe a dozen repeat clients who've been doing tours with me now for a couple of years. And a number of them are people I actually met at MoMA teaching courses there. And so, you know, MoMA has a pretty extensive course program, which is great. And a lot of people come in and take the survey course from 1880 to 1945. And they come in with no knowledge. And then that's sort of an introduction. And a lot of those people have done other classes with me that have been very specific and, you know, go to either Chelsea or specific parts of the Met or special exhibitions with the Guggenheim or the Whitney or wherever. And that I think for a lot of them, the goal for me, for those people, is that, number one, I'm sort of teaching them how to look in a more analytical way. And number two, I'm teaching them to feel comfortable not knowing what they're looking at.
Right.
And sort of working through it, which I think, you know, I can think of a couple people who specifically would say to me at the beginning of these MoMA courses, like, I only like pretty art.
Right.
Or I only like representational art. Abstraction, I don't get it. What's the point? And so for me, the goal is always, I'm not trying to make you like it. I'm trying to help you feel comfortable with it and at least appreciate it and not completely push it away.
Yeah. That's a really, that sounds like a really smart framing device, you know, that you say, just try to get comfortable. It's kind of a little bit, you know, therapy language, but it's like, try not to be uncomfortable with what you're looking at. You know, don't judge it just yet. You know, just be open with the lack of knowledge, the lack of comfort with this thing. And maybe you will actually, it will serve you down the line, because even more sophisticated viewers know, at least they should know, that they're going to see particularly contemporary art at some point that they don't have a handle on. And many of them out of instinct will say, oh, I hate this, or, you know, this is too over the top, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. And I think that an important point that I always try to make, especially with contemporary art, is, you know, when I do my Chelsea gallery tours, we usually go to 5 or 6 galleries. In, you know, two and a half hours, depending on the group. And I will almost always take them to a show that either I don't like or I think most of the group won't like, depending upon what I know about them. And those are almost invariably the best conversations.
Wow, yeah.
because people have such strong responses. So...
Is there a show I'm sorry to interject. Is there a show, since we're talking pretty abstractly, that comes to mind in this regard?
Sure. Yeah, I can just tell you the most recent one.
Sure.
And I should say this is an example of a show that I did like or do like, but not that it matters, but
it matters.
It was a work or an exhibition of works by Thomas Schutte called Frauen, Women. And there are a series, I don't know if you're familiar, but there are a series of sculptures that he made first in clay and then, as he often does, enlarged into bronze and steel. And I believe there's also a third set that wasn't there in aluminum. And so I think... there were 4 sculptures on view at Skarstedt Gallery, and then there was a series of etchings based on the sculptures. And so the idea behind the sculptures is to deconstruct or deform the female nude. And some of them are pretty violent. You know, one of them, the body is sort of cut into pieces and put back together, kind of like a cubist painting, but out of bronze. Another is a reclining female nude, and her face is replaced with what I interpreted to be a vagina, but someone else thought it was a mouth, which is, I guess, not as problematic in some ways. But either way, you know, they were works that, and they're big, and so they provoked a really strong visceral response.
Right.
And when I took the first group there, because I think over the course of the last 3 months, the show was up for a while, I took maybe 4 different groups. And the first group was mixed gender, so some women, some men. And the responses were very mixed. A lot of the men liked them. One of the men whose wife was there didn't like them, but it's like, oh, do you really not like them? Are you saying you don't like them? Who knows? And his wife hated them. And then I took another group, but that was just women. And, you know, I think there were 10 of them, and all but one person really was offended by them.
Right, right.
So, but what's interesting is, you know, then you get into this conversation about, okay, why do you find them offensive? And, okay, let's assume that this artist does not have negative feelings towards women, which I don't believe he does. or let's assume that's not the point, how might we find value in them,
mm-hmm.
you know, from an aesthetic standpoint?
Mm-hmm.
Or how could this be about not deconstructing women per se, but the idea of the ideal female body?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's really what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes an interesting exercise of separating your first emotional, visceral response from a more intellectual one.
Sure. You know what, Lauren? I don't know much about art, but I know what I like.
But are you willing to look at the things that you don't like?
Right. Well, as you're giving that example, you know, I imagine it would be fairly similar, but I mean, he is Shuta, I guess you could describe as a fairly traditional artist in a sense, you know, as far as his, that it's figurative and whatnot and traditional materials. I had to wonder, as you were saying that, if you've ever gone anywhere near like Thomas Hirshhorn or Jason Rhodes, you know, or God forbid Richard Prince, you know, or something like that. And if it would be kind of a similar reaction, or if it would be even different.
I haven't done Hirshhorn with a group. I did take a group into, it's slightly different though, because this was my Hunter student. So
what are you teaching,
you know,
at Hunter?
I'm currently teaching modern architecture, but over the summer I taught a class called Art in the City,
mm-hmm.
which is basically all field trips. It's an experimental course, and we did a lot of the major museums. We did one class in Chelsea, one class on the Lower East Side. We looked at a lot of public art. One of the galleries that we went to on the Lower East Side was Terrence Coe's exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an entire beehive that was in this back gallery. So you sort of walk through an entire gallery full of dirt, and then you get to the back room, which had a mound of dirt, and then you climb up into, I think the correct title of the work was chapel, because you can sort of go inside this enclosed space. And then you look up and there's actually a beehive.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of my students really didn't like it. And
mm-hmm.
some of them were very afraid because of the bee component.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, like, you know, the gallery's full of dirt. And that's a much more open-minded group than, you know, a group of retired women from wherever,
right.
just because they're a lot younger and a lot of them are artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, the conceptual work is difficult. Sometimes I'll go there if I think it's strong enough and it's going to provoke a good conversation. I took a group into the most recent Carrie Mae Weems exhibition that's currently up in Chelsea, and the work is very political.
Mm-hmm.
And that was difficult with a group of entirely white people, because it's all about race.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I try to have these conversations, but I err more on the side of getting into work that is difficult and at times political or controversial than something that is super conceptual that I think is not going to have enough there maybe for me to... I sometimes have trouble teaching it, so that's my shortcoming.
I see. Yeah, I was curious when you were talking about that. You mentioned before that you sometimes try to take groups to shows that you don't like. I'm curious, what do you know of the ceiling that you have? I don't know if ceiling's maybe not the right word, but, you know, where you just mentioned your limitations, where as far as either content or type of work, you know, you get turned off or you don't get it, or however you want to put it.
I mean, I think my general rule of thumb is that for me, both as a viewer, and an art historian and an educator / tour guide,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think for something to be considered good art for me,
mm-hmm.
It needs to have one or both of the following characteristics. It either needs to be aesthetically interesting or impressive. So it might not be interesting, but it could be, you know, really technically impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And if not that, then the idea behind it should be provocative.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't
mm-hmm.
need to be provocative in a, like, a controversial way, but it should provoke some sort of thought.
Sure.
So, of course, there's work that doesn't look that interesting, but when you really read about it and get into what's going on, it becomes interesting, or the other way around. So if it doesn't have one or both of those, I'm probably not going to like it that much, but I'm also probably not going to be able to really have a good conversation about it or lead a good conversation about it. And so then I feel like, you know, why there's so much good art out there, why am I going to spend my time on that?
Right, right. So I don't know if this is a good example, but maybe like austere, you know, minimal abstraction that maybe is not,
right.
That's very unflamboyant. I mean, even if you like it, I imagine that would be a really tough sell for any of your even more sophisticated groups.
Well, you know, I'll have to get back to you because I'm about to do a tour of Agnes Martin at the Guggenheim.
Right, right. Okay, yeah.
And that falls exactly into that category. And I work at the Guggenheim and I've done some, and I work with school groups. And so I've done some high school tours of it already. One went really great earlier today. Another fell flat. I thought it was going well. And then at the end of it, a bunch of them said, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I was like, but I think you do get it. It's actually not as heady as, you know, you might think. Her work isn't conceptual. It's very literal. So
yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what the group I'm going to take through it this weekend thinks of it, because I do like her work, but I have a hard time saying enough about it, to be perfectly honest. And my tours usually run, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours. And so I'm a little worried
mm-hmm.
that I'm not going to have enough differentiation for that much time.
Right.
Even though the show is beautiful, it really becomes a show sort of about, you know, slow, quiet, sustained looking.
Exactly. Yeah. Her work is a perfect example of art that is very resistant to conversation or dialogue, or certainly presentation, you know, because it's the kind of thing that's where the work sort of the subtext of the work says, you know, this exists in a visual language because it cannot exist absolutely
right
in a textual language. And so good luck trying to talk about it for a very long time.
Right. And I guess along those lines, there's another interesting example is on Kawara.
Sure.
And he had a retrospective at the Guggenheim 2 years ago now, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was last year, I'm forgetting. Maybe this will happen with Martin's work too. When the On Kawara show opened, I was totally afraid that there wouldn't be enough to talk about. And they were some of the best conversations. Those tours were some of the best conversations I've ever had about art.
Wow. Can you give me an example?
I think what was really interesting was there were two things that came up that were surprising, because I guess what I realized is I didn't know his work that well. I was really familiar with the date paintings, but
right.
Other than that, I didn't know. I don't know if you're familiar. He has an entire series of postcards that he sent while he was traveling, and they just say, I woke up at whatever time he woke up. And they're always from the city. It's a postcard of a picture from the city that he's in.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent them to collectors and other artists and friends in New York.
Right.
And so the Guggenheim got, I think, about 1,200 of them together for the show.
Mm.
And they were installed in these glass cases where, you know, they were vertical, though, so you could see both sides, and you sort of walked down the ramp and
mm-hmm.
and looked at one side, then looked at the other.
Mm-hmm.
And what was striking for a lot of visitors, and then we talked about it was, number one, how close it is to social media today. This sort of constant, for Ankhawara, you know, he was just announcing it to one person, but this announcing to the world what you're doing, and it becomes this existential experience of looking where you realize, well, here's a guy who's literally saying, I'm still alive every day. Like, I woke up. That's it. And then, you know, sort of looking at the second layer, which is, why does he wake up at such weird times? Like, you know, some days he wakes up at 6 a.m. Other days he wakes up at 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. Other days he wakes up at 3. You know, what's going on with that? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this conversation of him being this sort of globe-budding artist very early and without very much money. And so I think it's the connection with, like, our constant diaristic approach to life now,
right,
and having to publicize it to someone other than ourselves, that was interesting. And then the other thing that I had never seen before, each of his paintings has a box, and the boxes have newspaper clippings from the day on which the painting was made. And so depending upon the size of the painting, the boxes are different sizes, so the larger ones have more clippings. And anyway, the point is, you look at those paintings and they're almost completely disassociated from space and any sort of context. But when you look at the boxes, you can match each date up with what was happening in the world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to see how people coming at it from different places, different generations, and different personal experiences read those headlines differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as someone born in 1982, really the only headlines that were making a lot of sense to me were from the last 20 years. I don't remember that much of what was going on in the 80s or early 90s very
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
for someone who was in, you know, their 60s, 70s, or 80s, that's a very different experience.
Yeah.
So, and then that led to a lot of different conversations. And I think what was really striking to me about those conversations was that I always thought of Ankhawara's work as very solipsistic. And it actually became much more about the viewer than about him.
Mm. Huh.
Yeah, so that was surprising in, you know, the best possible way.
Yeah, and this whole time, I was wondering, it doesn't sound like it ever became, as one might suspect, it never became a question with these groups about, you know, is this art? You know, it's so sort of flat and uncolored and, you know, and what have you. It's very conceptual, obviously, in a lot of ways. But it doesn't sound like it. Sounds like people were able to get into the connections much more than that.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of conversations about, is this art? Why is this art? And
right.
the answer that I usually gave was, well, first of all, these are harder to make than you think.
Mm.
They're very meticulously made, and he did all the letters freehand. You know, he didn't use stencils, so that impressed people.
Right.
And the fact that he had to finish it on that day or else he destroyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But then also the point that I tried to make with a lot of different groups that I think was convincing to people, although I'm sure some people weren't overly blown away by it, was that the product for Ankhawara wasn't just those paintings or postcards or his, you know, other works on paper, whatever you want to look at. It was his art was his life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was the whole practice.
Practice.
So I think, I'm sorry. not mine. His.
Right, his. Yeah. right. You know, you mentioned, and we haven't really talked about that, you know, that you teach also at these various places. So it sounds like you've been teaching at the Guggenheim, at MoMA, have you been teaching at the Whitney even as well?
I worked at the Whitney for a couple of months, but I don't work there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been teaching also at the Morgan Library and Museum for a number of years, which is a pretty interesting institution that very few people know about.
Right.
And then I teach undergraduate classes at Hunter College.
Right. Yeah, no, so the reason that, that I ask is because one can maybe picture you, especially now that you're sort of just between gigs at the Met, kind of flitting around the Upper East Side, you know, to all of these institutions. Does it ever feel to you like you're in sort of museum row bubble kind of thing?
Yeah, very often it does. You know, it's not uncommon to have a day where I'm at three different places and, you know, I'm somewhere in the morning, another place in the afternoon, and then maybe my teaching schedule at Hunter, I usually teach night classes.
Mm-hmm.
So I may be there in the evening. So there's a lot of running around, but you're absolutely right that the running around is in a very specific area.
Yeah.
And a very specific sort of sector of the city. Yeah, I don't know what to do about that.
What part of town do you live in?
I actually live in Brooklyn.
Okay, what part of Brooklyn?
I live in Carroll Gardens.
Carroll Gardens, okay. Just because the reason I ask is because I can clearly see, even though it's a nice part of Brooklyn as opposed to, you know, say, Bushwick or what have you. Sorry, Bushwick people, I don't mean to diss your neighborhood, but but
it's just a different definition of nice.
Yeah, thank you. The whole point of this is that, you know, even if you're going from nice Upper East Side to nice Carroll Gardens, you're still changing demographics, you're still changing cultures. You know, it's a very specific culture up there with a ton of tourists, right, on the Upper East Side, you know, and then as your job will well attest, I would imagine, you know, a lot of well-to-do people with time to take tours and museums. You know, so I guess I don't know if I'm trying to force too hard this image of you sort of getting whiplash from going from that bubble to, you know, the outside world or the real world or whatever. But there's got to be some points where you are leaving the Upper East Side and you're going, oh, you know, and something changes in you somehow, maybe.
It's an interesting question. I think about it a lot. These different worlds within New York, and then I'm not going to get into recent events, but just realizing again and again that you're in a bubble. That's sort of the point, right? And so whether it's basically a Venn diagram of bubbles, and you know,
right,
there's this funny overlap that's me and a handful of other people who live in Brownstone, Brooklyn, and commute to the museums. And I think that I've thought about this a lot in terms of like my identity within the art world or within New York. And what's really funny is that I actually kind of like the Upper East Side in a way that I used to hate it. It's switched on me. And I think the reason that I like it more now, and I actually like Brooklyn less, but I think a lot of people will understand, it's Brooklyn has become so self-aware of its image and so hip and cool and, you know, for lack of a better term, has basically jumped the shark in a lot of areas. And
right.
And the Upper East Side has maintained a very consistent identity in a way that in a city like New York or Los Angeles, too, I think is kind of both refreshing and reassuring. And it's actually, you know, obviously Fifth Avenue Museum Mile is very, very expensive real estate, but there are parts of the Upper East Side that are cheaper than my neighborhood by a long shot.
Yeah. You know, that I'm glad you said that, because that was exactly what I was thinking when you mentioned, you know, Brooklyn jumping the shark, is because I've had a few conversations with guests saying that, you know, I mean, for the most recent one that comes to mind is Emily, this woman, Emily Clucci, who is an art writer who lives in East Village, you know, in Alphabet City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was looking, and she just been in this place for like a year and or less. And she looked around and was like, you know, Manhattan is cheaper than Brooklyn by far. And that's just so counterintuitive in so many ways. And yet, there you have it, you know, with most of these Brooklyn neighborhoods, as you said, it's just, you can use whatever metaphor you want, but the reality seems to be that the real estate for somebody looking for a place to rent or buy even is more expensive.
Yeah. I will tell you a very funny story that just happened to me relating to this particular idea.
Mm-hmm.
I wear this, I have this watch. It's made by a brand called Time Will Tell. And it's kind of a funny, clunky plastic watch that I bought at this store on Madison and 81st Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I never see people wearing them. But more recently, I've noticed a couple women like on the F train wearing the same watch as me. And they come in, I don't know, 30 different colors. And you always notice it because they're very bright. Mine is like a jade green color.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw this woman last night. She sat down next to me and she has on the same watch. And I said, oh, I like your watch, you know, haha. And we start talking and I'm like, where did you get it? And she's like, oh, the store in Park Slope has them in every color. And I immediately got like, I had this very like disgusted reaction, like, oh, I'm wearing the Park Slope watch.
Oh, no.
Like, I have no problem wearing the Upper East Side watch.
Right.
But because I actually at this point, like almost identify more with the Upper East Side because I spend so much more time here. I never go to Park Slope. So it's like this really funny flip.
Yeah. So the store is actually based in Park Slope?
I don't remember the name of the store, so I can't give you any product placement.
But, no.
No. I mean, she said some name of a store, and she said there are two stores that have them now. They're great. All my friends and I, we all bought them. And I was like, oh.
Right. So you had a case of kind of over-Brooklynification nausea, essentially.
Yeah, and this incident last night sort of brought it to a head for me because I was like, I like that on the Upper East Side, I have this like kind of quirky object that happens to be from up there. I get compliments on this watch all the time. I realize it's a really silly example,
mm-hmm.
but it's visible and,
sure.
you know, and it's like, oh, that's sort of arty looking and it doesn't look fancy. It doesn't, obviously if I was, you know, living in a classic seven, I wouldn't be wearing this. And so it sort of looks a little out of place, but happens to be from there. And then now I'm like, oh, I really am fulfilling the Brooklyn stereotype by having this object that now all of these Brooklynite women wear.
Yeah.
And, you know, and now I think I might need to get a new watch. And so it's like mm-hmm. this funny, like I obviously am from Brooklyn. I live there. I mean, I'm not from there, but, I've been in Brooklyn for 9 years now and I very much identify as a Brooklynite and yet am sort of having trouble with a lot of the businesses that have come into my neighborhood in the last 3 or 4 years.
Has it ever been on the table looking in Manhattan, particularly the Upper East Side, to live? Or, I mean, do you want that separation as well?
I think I do actually like the separation. It's annoying to be on the subway for upwards of, you know, 45 minutes to an hour each way. But I like the separation. And for, you know, financial reasons, I have a very good deal in my apartment. I'm not going to be moving anytime soon.
Right,
But no, I have thought about if I were to move, where would I want to move? And I actually really don't have an answer to that question because I get stuck. You know, I love the aesthetic of my neighborhood. It's very neighborhoody. I have a lot of friends there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the local businesses that have stuck around are wonderful. And I have trouble coming up with a place that I like more, even if I do have a lot of problems with where I am.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a subtext though, that there are more Brooklyn's than Carroll Gardens, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
So no,
I mean,
you're absolutely right.
Right. I mean, there's Williamsburg, obviously Bushwick, perhaps Greenpoint, you know, et cetera.
Right. And that's why I like it better than those places.
Yeah, right.
I'm almost, you know, obviously we're talking over the phone. You haven't met me, but I'm aggressively unhip.
Oh, okay.
I'm not,
tell me.
You wouldn't think, you wouldn't think that if you met me. I mean, I dress the part of, you know, someone who's in the art world, and I wear skinny jeans and look vaguely like a hipster, but, you know, mm-hmm. a little bit more polished. But no, I don't feel comfortable often in places that I think are super image conscious and very trendy.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't feel comfortable. I just am not interested in being there because, number one, I'm too old. You know, those places were great when I was in my mid-20s, late-20s. But in my mid-30s, I don't really need to go to the hottest new bar. And I'm probably going to be frustrated by a lot of the clientele.
Right.
And, you know, and the prices are ridiculous for no good reason. And I have found that I would say in the last 2 or 3 years, I've really, to a certain extent, lost interest in keeping up with the hottest new thing, not in art, but in terms of restaurants and bars and, you know, some of the other things that take a lot of energy to keep up on.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've kind of just decided I'm aware. But, you know, I used to spend a lot of time reading restaurant reviews and sort of checking out new spots. And now I just, it doesn't appeal to me as much.
Sure. Yeah. But to bring it back to the galleries, which is sort of where we started, when you mentioned not feeling entirely comfortable in these, you know, cutting edge or hip or, you know, of the moment places, when you're at, and I don't know if this is a great segue, but when you're at certain galleries, or have you been at certain galleries where maybe you feel like your tour is not as welcome as others, and decide maybe that that's not a gallery that you will return to?
Sure. Like I said before, I think, you know, the Chelsea galleries by and large welcome group tours. Number one, because they're bigger. And number two, because they're not hip. They don't really care about that. You know, and they know. So that's fine. And then the Lower East Side, I think it's a little bit hit or miss. And I always, you know, the way that I prepare for these tours, I basically do a reconnaissance mission, and I walk around and I figure out what I want to take groups to. And I always ask, if it's a gallery I haven't taken a group to in the past, I always check and see that it's okay. And, you know, and I basically tell them the demographic of the group. And when I started doing Chelsea tours a couple years ago, because I didn't initially do them, I was worried it was going to be too much work all the time to keep, you know, changing everything around. But when I started doing them, I was actually like a little bit embarrassed, to be totally honest. Like you're in this space that is kind of an arbiter of taste and kind of hip, and you're bringing in a group that, you know, really isn't that. And I went through a big, I think, transition personally in terms of trying to figure out who my audience is over the last few years. And I hired an assistant who was 6 years younger than me. And I said, you know, I really want to try to get more young clients and, you know, repeat clients. And so I offered my tours for less money for them. But what I realized is that's actually not my demographic, and it's not where I should be trying to grow my business, because that isn't who I am. I come from an academic background. I'm not an artist. I'm not a contemporary specialist, though I do at this point know a fair amount about contemporary art. I'm really a modernist, and I think that the way I talk about art is to, in some ways, academic for what, you know, the early 20s person who just wants to see all the hottest shows at the moment and get a flavor, it's too much for what they want. I go too slowly. I ask too many questions. And I am not super friendly to people taking a million pictures all the time while I'm talking.
Right.
So I think, you know, that for me was a bit of a realization of, okay, there are other people in the city who are filling that particular niche, and that's not mine.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a good point that you mentioned that you have this particular niche. Was it, and is it still, but particularly was it challenging to sort of launch the business? You know, I mean, was it more organic that you started working with people like from your classes, or was there ever a point where you had to scramble to find people?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, it's always a bit of a scramble. Because, well, that's not totally true. I mean, there are certain things that are very popular and I don't have trouble filling, and there are other things that I do because I want to do them, and you know, they may not be the best sellers, you use that term,
right?
And I think that the way it started was very organic. I, as I said, was working for another tour company and was also teaching these classes at MoMA, and it kind of arose out of those two different places where some of the clients that I was taking around for the other company were asking for my information separately. And then, and I, you know, had no legal obligation not to do that, not to give it out. And then people at MoMA were sort of doing the same and saying, now I understand this particular period of art history. What came before 1880? I don't know anything about how we got here or what came after 1950, for example. Would you consider leading other classes doing that? And so that's how the classes actually came about, because I was doing private tours sort of by word of mouth before. And then I had a group of about 10 people from one of my MoMA classes who sort of got together, and we all sort of talked about what I could do that would extend the class back and forwards in time. And we started doing a series at the Met, and then I did some other gallery classes with them. And that's how I came up with this idea of doing group classes in other museums that you could just sign up for, as opposed to a private tour where you already have a group and then you call me.
Right. And So where does most of the scramble come then? Like right now or recently?
So I guess it is and isn't a scramble. One of the nice things about my particular job, for lack of a better term, because I basically have four jobs, is that because I have all of these different jobs, if I don't have a lot of private tours or work from my own business in, you know, September, for instance, but I have enough of the other stuff coming in, it's fine. And vice versa. And, you know, I pretty much will always privilege my own business work because it's more lucrative and I, you know, usually enjoy it the most, but I try to sort of balance it out. And I like doing all of it, and that's what's nice. But the comes in when, you know, there are slow times of the year. September is really slow. Not a lot of tourists are coming to New York in September. August is basically dead for New Yorkers, but you do often have a lot of tourists. So it's sort of a question of, you know, if that's when I want to take off some time, is that the best time? January slow. So the scramble comes in during those slow months, and you have to make enough during the high season for that to be okay. And also when, you know, I have a class that only three or four people have signed up for, and I've basically just decided my policy is I need a minimum of three people to run it, but that's not making a ton of money. But I still want to do it because I think it's, you know, it's very bad business to cancel on people.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So,
right. So is there, I mean, within all of that, the question, one of the questions for me is, I need more people, you know, for let's say December, you know, before the holidays, you know, I need more people. What are the steps?
I think that the most effective marketing tool for me is very old fashioned. It's word of mouth and it's direct emails. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I send out usually every other week an email to, I have a list of, you know, about 600 people at this point, and just tell them about my upcoming classes and remind them that, you know, I offer private tours and they make really good gifts. And especially around the holidays, you know, I sort of put that in there.
Right.
I'm bad at self-promotion. I don't really enjoy doing it. So I sort of struggle with anything. The emails are fine, mm-hmm. but I don't like doing a lot of like social media plugging. I do use Instagram a lot, but I don't do it in a very salesy way.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at my feed, it's fairly information heavy. Because I think that is kind of my brand. And so, yeah, it's really sort of just about reminding people, trying to give out my information whenever it seems not too inappropriate.
Right.
You know, giving out a card. And I guess I will say at this point, I don't really scramble anymore because I have enough repeat. My schedule is full of enough repeat business. Like mm-hmm. this group that I work with from Long Island, they do 30 tours with me a year. So
wow.
that's a lot. And once I got hired for that, that really took off a lot of pressure in terms of, you know, being able to afford my lifestyle.
What does that mean?
I guess I just mean New York's expensive. That's it.
Yeah, right. Even if you're not going to the hot, keeping up with the hottest restaurants and bars, apparently.
Right, because, you know, they're all basically the same price at this point.
Yeah, right. Are there any...
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, why don't we see if we can wrap up with, you know, and I know this is a bit of a non sequitur, but are there any other tour anecdotes that you can think of that we would be remiss if we did not hear?
You know, there are so many that I was like racking my brain to think of the best ones before we spoke.
Right.
And I guess I came up with two that are pretty good. And one... One has to do with kids and one has to do with adults.
Perfect.
You know, and they're all very, I don't come off that great in many of them, but, that's what makes for a good story. Right.
So
there was an exhibition at the Guggenheim, last winter into the spring. It was a retrospective of David Fishley and, Peter Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, I just mixed up their names. Peter Fishley and David Weiss.
Fishley and Weiss, AKA. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so, you know, their first series is called the Sausage Series, and it's all of these photographs they took of objects in their kitchen that they turned into these sort of interesting scenes. And one of them, or a number of them, include sausages or parts of sausages.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was taking around a group of fifth graders, and it was Friday, and it was projected to be a big snowstorm that weekend. And we had spent a lot of time talking about how you can make really interesting art out of everyday objects. And, you know, at the end of the tour, one of the kids said something. He said, "Oh, Lauren, do you have any plans for the snowstorm?" And I was like, "No, I don't really know what I'm going to be doing. I don't know how bad it'll be, but I'm sure I'll figure out something fun to do with the stuff in my apartment, right?" And he's like, "Yeah." And as they were saying goodbye, I was like, "Okay, kids, well, don't forget to play with your sausages this weekend." And most didn't really even get it.
Right.
But one of the teachers just shot me this look of like, are you serious? And
right. That's great.
And so that was a good, you know, there are a lot of like sort of slips that I have mm-hmm. where I make a lot of jokes on my adult tours. I'm very sarcastic. And that goes over really well most of the time. But then sometimes with kids, it's like, what is she talking about?
Right, right.
So, yeah, there's just one more that's sort of like along these same sexual innuendo lines.
Mm-hmm.
I had I think it was a group of eighth graders maybe at the Whitney. And we had looked at one very large self-portrait, or it wasn't a self-portrait. It was a portrait of Julian Schnabel that was a 10-foot-tall candle
mm-hmm.
by Urs Fischer, and it was burning down. And then we looked at a Charles Ray portrait of him in a bottle, and he's only like 10 inches tall. So it was 10 feet to 10 inches. I said, how is it different to look at these two sculptures, one really big, one really small? You know, how do they feel different to look at? And this girl just goes, well, miss, size matters. And I'm like, oh, really? What do you mean by that? She's like, I don't know. I just hear it all the time from my mom. I'm like, okay. There are these very funny incidents because you're working with, or I work with kids from all over the city. And, you know, I love that part of it. And that's what keeps the job really interesting to your question from the beginning of the interview, you know. I might have asked that same question to eight different groups, but the answers are never the same.
Right, right. How old was the kid who said size matters?
She was in eighth grade.
Got it.
So you think by then she might have an inkling what it means, but you don't really know.
Right,
yeah. And then if you're interested, I do have one more adult story.
Yeah, please. Let's do the adult.
So, you know, as I mentioned, one of the components of this group from Long Island, they take a bus into the city. And one of the parts of my job is that I have to make sure everyone gets back on the bus after the tour ends. So it was my first year of doing this job. So about this was a year and a half ago. And I counted everyone on the bus, and the bus leaves. And about 10 minutes later, I get a call from this woman, and she said, Lauren, where's the bus? This is, we'll call her Denise. And she goes, where's the bus? And I said, the bus left and you're on it, as far as I can tell, because I have my sheet and I'm looking at the numbers and, you know, everyone was there. And turns out she wasn't on the bus. And, you know, and she's an 80-year-old woman and is very afraid of having to get herself back to suburban Long Island without this coach bus.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this moment of, first of all, like, oh, shoot, I really screwed up. And then second of all, like, I can't believe this is my job. I didn't realize how much of my job was customer service oriented.
Right.
And now, like, it's not that hard to get out there. Come on. And then, you know, this all happens within a minute, realizing, like, okay, this is part of my job. And part of the job is also, it's customer service. It's having empathy for all these people that you're taking around. And, you know, this woman is really afraid of being in the city by herself. So I took her in a cab to Penn Station and got her on the train. And, you know, gave her money to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely, on the one hand, completely ridiculous. And on the other hand, just, I think, a sort of interesting epiphany of like, oh, this is different from the job I thought I was doing.
Yeah.
And it's a part of the job that I don't love. But at the end of the day, I'm actually pretty good at customer service. I worked in restaurants for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I kind of know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came to terms with the fact that that is a large component of it, I became a lot happier
right.
and didn't, you know, get annoyed by those parts as much.
Right.
So it actually was kind of funny because I, you know, after it happened, I called my boyfriend at the time and And he's like, well, I mean, she didn't die, right? And I'm like, no, she didn't die. But I, you know, she's an 8-year-old woman who was afraid of being in the city by herself. And he's like, that's ridiculous. I'm like, it's not ridiculous, actually. That's like, this is my bubble, you know.
How did she get checked off on the bus if she wasn't there? Do you know?
Well, yes, I do know. What happened was I have basically an attendance sheet and everyone has to sign in and give me their phone numbers for this exact reason. And the bus is not to leave, obviously, without everybody there. And what happened was I go through and call everybody's name and someone must have raised her hand twice. For her name and then for this other woman's name.
Right.
And this is the funny part of the story because
right.
It's like, how did that happen? And, you know, and I called the supervisor, the head of adult education in this town and told him what happened. And he's like, Lauren, I've been doing this for 30 years. Never has anyone not gotten back on the bus. Or never has the bus left without someone.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, I'm not trying to make you feel worse because I can tell you already feel terrible. But this is a new one.
Wow.
And I'm like, thanks.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Well, this has been a wild bus ride, Lauren.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And we're out. Thanks so much to Lauren for talking to us. I hope you enjoyed that and got a nice piece of the art tour culture. Be interested to hear what your experience with art tours are. Feel free to tweet, IG, email, or what have you, your stories to the conversation at Artist Podcast. And let's get to some bad advice, and let me give you an update on that Agnes Martin tour that Lauren did. But first, just want to quickly remind you that this is a listener-supported show. I know at this time, a lot of us are donating to the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, other important nonprofits at this time in our history. But there, as I said last week, there is still a need for culture and entertainment in our lives. And I like to think that maybe the conversation is part of that dialogue. So, you know, a modest donation, $10, $20 would be super appreciated. And if you are able to donate $20 to the show, you will be able to receive the bonus episode with Max Maslansky, as well as a newer bonus short featuring Matt Gleason singing Lou Rawls and trashing his alma mater. So I think you have a lot to get out of your donation if you are so inclined. I have been asking for your donations of late. I will ask again. That's how the show keeps going. If not for me, I will be happy to pass along some of your donation money to Chris Ford and Cooper Lovano, who both help out on the show to make this show happen every week. And now Kate Mitchell as well, who will be providing us with the bad advice. So if you would like to support the show financially, you can go to theconversationpod.com/support, leave a nice donation there. If you don't like using PayPal, you can certainly write a check if you prefer. Just write me and I'll give you the address. Of course, you can also support the show by leaving a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the website, theconversationpod.com, and follow on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, fan on Facebook, and so much more. So thank you in advance for your support. It's very much appreciated. And so what Lauren said about the Agnes Martin tour, she said they have gone really well. She leaves a lot of time for quiet looking, punctuated by Martin's own words. She also found a quote where Martin talks about watching the clouds for 30 days straight and realizing they never repeat exactly, then wanting to create paintings that are like that, similar but slightly different. She also said that ultimately people found the work much more engaging than she expected. So apparently it went better than she had thought, and was able to fill that time talking about the clouds and even compared it to the spiral of Frank Lloyd Wright's Guggenheim. All right, so let's get to some bad advice before we go, courtesy of Kate Mitchell. The higher up you go, the more mistakes you are allowed. Right at the top, if you make enough of them, it's considered to be your style. Fred Astaire. the best works don't necessarily get to auction. I like to draw, and maybe I give away a little drawing, and then it eventually ends up at auction. And the critics say, oh, that's a bad drawing. Well, I didn't say it was so wonderful. Marlene Dumas. You're in better company historically if people don't understand what you're doing. Elliot Smith. And finally, for the closer of the week, I don't know what the question is, but the answer is sex. Woody Allen. Ooh. Ouch. I hope that's not a trigger for you guys at this time in our political history or social history. But in any case, that's bad advice for the week. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate your listening. I hope you enjoyed that. And I hope you'll come back around next week. Please do spread the word about the show. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.